Welcome to WHRO's Weekly Edition. I'm Jordan Christie.
And I'm Barry Graham.
We highlight the week's news and stories happening all over Hampton Roads. We're rounding out July with a great set of stories. 2 years ago, the Navy released a plan to put all the barracks in Hampton Roads under a private company, but updates have gone quiet since the announcement.
The family of Miles Easton is celebrating his legacy with a reunion in Chesapeake more than 200 years after he was handed down as property in a slave owner's will.
And tick bites are climbing in Virginia, so researchers at Old Dominion University are using a new tick robot method to fight them.
We're trying to prevent an area from being heavily tick infested, and so it could at least give some level of protection.
It's WHRO's Weekly Edition. Virginia is searching for the next company to administer standardized testing to public school students. WHRO's Ashley White reports it marks one of the final steps in a years-long process to analyze and improve the state's assessment system.
The goal is to find a vendor who can provide more modern and rigorous standards of learning assessments, or SOLs. It will need to provide timely information to educators and families and be accessible to students with disabilities and English learners. The current vendor hasn't been competitively revisited since 2005, according to a spokesperson with VDOE. That contract will end in 2027. The General Assembly, in 2022, directed VDOE to create a work group to identify what other state assessments do well, what Virginia educators and families want, and what next steps are needed. Vendors have until mid-September to submit proposals. Ashley White, WHRO News.
An ambitious plan to put all the barracks in Hampton Roads under a private company has grown quiet after the Navy made the announcement 2 years ago. WHRO's Steve Walsh fills us in on the current state of the plan.
The plan would transfer all of the housing for junior sailors in Hampton Roads to a company which would build new barracks and demolish rundown buildings in the region. It would be the largest project of its kind in the military, valued at roughly $1.8 billion. Leslie Gold, then the head of Navy Installations Command, first announced the plan to WHRO in March of 2024. Hunt Investment Properties told WHRO in February that the company was within 2 months of securing the money to fund the deal. Spokesperson for both the company and the Navy now say they have no new information to release. Advocates raise questions about expanding privatization. Several tenants have sued companies the military hired to run family housing. Steve Walsh, WHRO News.
Communities throughout the region need poll workers to support the November elections. WHRO's John Doucette shares how many positions still need to be filled.
108 polling locations will be open in Virginia Beach on Election Day in November. For Virginia's most populous city, at least 1,200 poll workers are needed. Like other communities, the city hires poll workers. Christian Logan is the Deputy Director of Elections in Virginia Beach. He says these workers play an important role.
We couldn't do it without them. We have a very small staff here, only 14 full-time staff, and then we ramp up with temporary employees to help us out.
In Virginia Beach, people can learn more online at voter.virginiabeach.gov. Those in other communities can contact their local registrar, and people can also apply online at the State Elections Department site. That's vote.virginia.gov. John Doucette, WHRO News.
With widespread drought front and center, water is on everyone's mind. So in June, when Caroline County asked Virginia Marine Resources Commission for permission to install an intake pipe in the Rappahannock River for drinking water, the hearing morphed into a litany of public concerns over water supplies. VPR's Pamela D'Angelo reports.
For the last 20 years, Caroline County has been working on a water plan for its growing population. But when Public Works Director Joseph Schiebel finally stood before Marine Resources Commissioners, he faced a barrage of questions.
How long-term effect down the road? I'm just curious. I probably shouldn't even go any further on it because that's a DEQ-related item as far as looking at that soil assessment. But the permit was unanimously approved
and will allow the county to build a facility that could remove up to 9 million gallons of water a day from the Rappahannock River. Originally, the county wanted 13 million gallons a day, 5 million a day for drinking water, and an unknown amount for cooling data centers. That led to a wave of protests. Here's Schiebel.
So when it became contentious, the board's like, we didn't want it for cooling anyway, let's drop it. So we just dropped it back to our needs. We've taken it completely out of our permit. The Board of Supervisors has also adopted ordinances that will not allow cooling facilities to be able to use potable water, period.
But public trust in their elected officials has been dented. People at the VMRC hearing, including representatives from the Rappahannock and Mattapani tribes, expressed continued concerns with whether 9 million gallons a day was really needed. And they worried about the health of the Rappahannock, which is listed as one of the country's most endangered rivers. Tribes wanted to know why the water, after it's used, would be returned to a different river, the Mattapani. The Mattapani tribe has since filed a legal challenge to the approval. Answers to some questions can be found in DEQ's annual Water Resources Report. And there's DEQ's manager for the state water supply, Whedon Clough.
This is the most intense drought that we've had in the Commonwealth since 2008, and it borders on the historic drought that we saw back in 2002.
For more than a decade, groundwater in Virginia has been stressed. DEQ now limits users. This has led to counties like Caroline to seek water from rivers. New businesses are advised to seek permits for surface water. But it's power plants that take up the most water. Every day, power plants in Virginia pull about 4.1 billion gallons of water from mainly rivers. That's right, billions per day.
Power generation typically has a 2% consumptive use.
The rest is cooled and returned to the source. The largest of these water consumers is Surrey Nuclear Power Plant, which takes 1.5 billion gallons a day from the James River.
Do the math on that. 2% of 1.5 billion. Yeah, it's like 30 million. So it's lost 30 million gallons per day.
And where does it go?
It goes in the atmosphere. It returns rain somewhere. So, you know, it becomes a cloud, and those are those cooling towers that you see, and, you know, they're discharging to the atmosphere, and yes, eventually they will condense and rain.
On the very last page of the Water Resources Report is an appendix about water transfers. This is like the proposed transfer of Rappahannock River water to the Mattapani River after it's been recycled by Caroline County. The largest transfer of water in the state comes from Lake Gaston in Southside, Virginia, to the city of Norfolk for processing. The final destination, the city of Virginia Beach. Other transfers include water from the Potomac River pulled by Fairfax County and provided to Loudoun County, which also uses it for data centers. From Richmond, I'm Pamela D'Angelo.
Still ahead on Weekly Edition, a task force studying safety issues in Virginia Beach held its first outreach session this week. But first, state officials are seeking input for the latest Virginia energy plan. WHRO's Katherine Hafner shares what they're seeking to learn.
The energy plan will outline the state's strategy for dealing with growing power demand and grid instability. The last one came out 4 years ago under Governor Glenn Youngkin. It prioritized an all-of-the-above approach, pursuing all power sources, including natural gas. Abigail Spanberger's version comes as Virginians are increasingly anxious about data centers and soaring electric bills. The governor has said she wants to reduce energy costs while pursuing the state's mandate to produce only clean power by 2045. State officials are gathering public feedback. People can fill out a survey on the Virginia Energy website through Friday. Katherine Hafner, WHRO News.
Go to WHRO.org to learn more.
Three constitutional amendments are on the ballot this fall. VPM News' Jad Khalil has a report on who is advocating for and against those measures.
So far, at least eight committees are registered to campaign in the upcoming fall referendums. Four of them are campaigning against an amendment that would put abortion rights into the Constitution, according to their campaign finance filings. But that might change.
The Code of Virginia envisions that the scope of a committee can change over time.
James Alcorn is the director of the election law program at William & Mary Law School. While the Virginia Catholic Conference, LLC, registered to advocate against the abortion amendment, it has flyers on its website pushing for a no vote on the marriage equality amendment and a yes vote on a voting rights amendment. Alcorn says committee names aren't binding either.
For example, somebody could create a committee in support of the Flat Earth Society, but decide to spend money for that committee against one of the specific referendum that are on the ballot this fall.
Early voting begins September 18th for November's election. Jad Khalil, VPM News.
Cell phones and some electronic devices are now allowed inside the courthouse in Virginia Beach. WHRO's John Doucette explains why.
The sheriff's office said the change is now in effect for visitors to the Virginia Beach courthouse. It follows new state law about portable electronic devices in courthouses. These can include laptops, tablets, and phones. In Virginia Beach, visitors can bring devices in. However, phones are turned off in the security screening area and placed inside a locking pouch. People will need to have the pouch unlocked as they leave the courthouse to get their phone back. Other devices must be turned off inside the courthouse. The sheriff's office told WHRO limited use of mobile devices is allowed only in a designated area on the first floor. Someone will be there to unlock security bags, then lock the bags up again before people leave the area with their phones. More details are available online at vbso.net. John Doucette, WHRO News.
Budget cuts have sharply reduced the Pentagon's efforts to find the remains of thousands of troops still missing from long-ago wars. And the impact is hitting one group of families especially hard. Jay Price reports for the American Homefront Project.
Raymond Echeverria Jr. of Roxborough, North Carolina, was 4 years old in 1966 when his father was reported missing. Raymond Sr., a Fort Bragg Green Beret, was part of a small reconnaissance team that had come under heavy fire in Laos. Family members hold out hope his remains can be recovered, but it gets harder as the Vietnam War slips further into history.
Some of the veterans that were there are dying off. You've got issues with bodies being there for 50, 60 years. You've got acidity issues in the soil. Time is passing, and they don't seem to be getting any closer to finding answers for a lot of Southeast Asia families.
The U.S. government's efforts to bring MIAs home sprang from a grassroots movement in the 1960s. More than 3,800 troops have been recovered, about 1,000 of those from the Vietnam War. But federal budget cuts this year would slash by more than two-thirds the number of recovery missions in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. That's according to the Pentagon Office responsible for the work, the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, or DPAA. Many of the more than 1,500 still missing from the Vietnam War are considered unrecoverable for various reasons, but others, like Echeverria's father, vanished under circumstances that make finding them more likely.
They know where the helicopter landed. They have done interviews with various, I call them NVA soldiers. They identified certain areas where they saw American bodies, so they've got a pretty good idea where they can go and excavate and look for them.
The DPAA says the budget cuts are part of Pentagon-wide reductions, and the effects were worsened by last year's government shutdown and fuel shortages in Southeast Asia tied to the war in Iran. This summer, the agency was placed under the Defense Department's Undersecretary for Personnel and Readiness, Anthony Tata. At a recent meeting, he told Vietnam MIA family members he'll lobby Congress and DOD leaders to get the funding restored.
I'm fully committed to increasing the budget for DPAA because it's a direct correlation for how many teams we can deploy into the field and how much research we can do and how many remains that we can process.
Senator Deb Fischer, a Nebraska Republican, also has introduced a bill to restore $40 million in funding, but its chances of passing are unclear. Ann Mills Griffiths, whose brother, James Mills, went missing in 1966 when his plane went down off the Vietnamese coast, was a longtime leader of the National League of POW/MIA Families. A skilled political operator who was close to President Ronald Reagan, she has fought for decades to get more funding for what became the DPAA, but she's long said the agency isn't prioritizing Vietnam cases as much as it should.
It's not at all satisfactory, especially with how hard we've worked and defended and fought for their assets and resources and priorities.
Even before the budget cuts, Vietnam War identifications were a fraction of those completed by the DPAA. The bulk of the agency's recoveries have come from World War II and the Korean War, where missing troops were more numerous and are often easier to find in places like POW cemeteries. But Raymond Echeverria Jr. says Vietnam War recoveries should be prioritized because family members who knew missing troops, like his father, are more likely to be alive.
Our prayer is that we're able to bring them home while we're still here before it goes to the next generation.
So far this year, out of more than 170 service members identified, just one was from the Vietnam War. I'm Jay Price reporting.
200 years ago, Miles Eason was handed down as property in a slave owner's will. Now his family will celebrate his legacy with a reunion in Chesapeake, as WHRO's Denise Watson reports.
When four generations of Easons gather this weekend, they will share stories, memories, and a history they only recently learned about. Francis Eason Lamb will be the primary storyteller. The 81-year-old Deep Creek resident recently learned that her great-great-great-grandfather, Miles Eason, was enslaved in Bertie County, North Carolina. Her nephew, Stacy Eason, began tracing the family's roots and discovered Miles Eason marked on an 1815 will. Because slave owners did not often keep records about their enslaved, tracing genealogy is challenging. Lamb isn't bitter about the past. She's inspired by the resilience of her ancestors.
But then to make it from slavery all the way to now, that's amazing. That is a blessing, and only by God.
This is expected to be the largest of the Eason reunions, with nearly 100 expected. Denise Watson, WHRO News.
Freelance writer Vicki L. Friedman contributed to this report.
A task force studying safety issues in Virginia Beach held its first outreach session with the public Tuesday. WHRO's John Doucette is back with this report.
The task force formed after concerns about sudden crowds, sometimes called pop-up events, and violence in the spring. It's expected to deliver recommendations later this year. Its work is about safety throughout the city, not just at the oceanfront. The first of a series of listening sessions brought people together to focus on issues involving faith-based and civil rights groups, including opportunities for young people. The Reverend Gary McCollum is a longtime community activist. He says there's more to discuss than just policing.
It has to be a holistic approach. It has to be policing. It has to be our justice system, but it also has to be schools. It has to be our faith community. It has to be our government putting its money where its mouth is.
A general community-wide listening session is scheduled Thursday. Information about the task force is online at virginiabeach.gov. John Doucette, WHRO News.
Poultry is one of Virginia's biggest farm commodities, and more than 15 million turkeys are processed in the Commonwealth each year. Chester, however, isn't one of them, thanks to a Nelson County couple, as Christine Cuda reports for partner station WVTF.
It's been 2 months since Dave Comer found Chester.
He was laying on the side of the road. I know it was a big animal, and I pulled over, and when I got out and I said, I'm upright, I was like, wow, that's a turkey. And so I picked him up and put him in the front seat, and we drove up here.
He drives around, and he parks right there, and I come over, and I say, are you okay? Is something wrong? He'd opened the truck door, and I look down, and there's this huge white thing on the ground.
That's Dave's wife, Christina. Dave, who retired from the Navy in 2007, didn't know a thing about turkeys, just that he couldn't leave this one that had likely fallen off a truck on its way to slaughter. Comer decodes Chester's moods by the magnificent color changes in his caruncles, eggshell blue to gray to bright red, and the puff of his feathers and strut. Still healing from his shattered bones and infected wounds, Chester now spends his days watching TV, snacking on romaine and watermelon, waiting for the FedEx man, and following the Comers around like, well, a 50-pound chick. The Comers have spent about $3,000 for Chester's care to date. Their vet says the turkey may live as long as 10 years, especially if he slims down a bit.
The rest of his life, he'll live comfortably with us, and he certainly deserves it. He's a good boy.
Reporting from Roseland, I'm Christine Cuter.
Ticks are on the rise in Virginia, along with the diseases they spread. Researchers at Old Dominion University are developing a unique approach to finding them, a tick robot. WHRO's Catherine Hefner reports from Chesapeake.
On a trail behind the preserve on the Elizabeth neighborhood, a group of ODU researchers are waving white flags. They slowly move along the path covered in pine needles, sweeping pole-mounted cloths back and forth.
It's the gold standard method of collecting ticks.
That's research technician Darian Dean with ODU's Tick Lab. She says this flagging method is an easy way to find specimens.
So the ticks think that something is passing by that could be a potential meal. So they latch on to this flag.
Then the team sticks them with tape and slips them into vials to study back at the campus lab. But today, these researchers aren't just collecting ticks. They're also testing a possible solution to fight the pesky parasites. ODU calls it the TickBot, a sort of robot on wheels. Basically, it's a remote-controlled car, roughly the size of a large house cat. The car drags a cloth coated in permethrin along the ground. It's a chemical that kills ticks. Professor Holly Gaff says we're never going to get rid of all of the ticks.
But the goal with the tick bot here is that we're trying to prevent an area from being heavily tick infested, and so it could at least give some level of protection.
Ticks are a growing problem in Virginia. The warming climate has driven some southern species to spread north. At the same time, northern ticks are moving down because of habitat changes.
Hampton Roads, we're kind of in this crossroads.
She says deer thrive in Virginia's forests, and deer bring ticks. Plus, suburbs are expanding from cities.
We move to the tick areas, like this beautiful place here, where we want to live in nature, but nature is not in balance, and so tick populations are often a reflection of how unbalanced the ecology is.
Ticks survive by feasting on the blood of humans and other animals. They're attracted to heat, movement, sound, and especially carbon dioxide that humans breathe out. In other words, pretty much everything we do makes us easy targets. The reason ticks are such a concern is that they can spread dangerous diseases. Lone star ticks are the most prevalent species in Hampton Roads. They can transmit a southern rash illness and the much-feared alpha-gal syndrome that causes an allergy to mammal products like meat and dairy. Black-legged or deer ticks are also around and can carry Lyme disease. Emily Pickle teaches at the Joint School of Public Health, run by ODU and Norfolk State University. She says tick-borne illness can be tricky to diagnose. Symptoms like fever and abdominal pain can point to other conditions, and often don't appear until weeks or months after a bite.
We know those cases are increasing, but it's a hard thing to explain to a physician, like to put all those pieces together in a way someone's like, oh, I recognize exactly what this is from.
The TickBot pilot project in Chesapeake started after the local Homeowners Association reached out for help. Most people the researchers encounter are well aware of the issue, like 7-year resident Andrew Hillman, who was biking by on a recent visit.
My wife and I call it downtown tick town because anytime in the summer, if we want to come down and, you know, walk to the dock or walk to the river, I'd say probably 9 times out of 10, you're going to have a tick when you get back home.
Hillman says he can't stay away from the easy access to nature.
We love all the wildlife. It's just, you know, the ticks kind of come with it.
Master's student Willow Baker says ODU's goal is to commercialize the tick bot to help residents like Hillman.
We've been able to really bridge the gap between the tick research and the communities that we're trying to reach that will possibly be driving these around their backyards in the future.
Officials emphasize the best disease prevention is to avoid getting bitten in the first place. Treat clothing with permethrin, tuck long pants into socks, and check your whole body when you get home. Katherine Hafner, WHRO News.
You've been listening to WHRO's Weekly Edition. We had help today from WHRO's John Doucette, Katherine Hafner, Steve Walsh, and Ashley White.
VPM's Jad Khalil, VPR's Pamela D'Angelo, WVTF's Christine Cooter, and Jay Price with the American Homefront Project. Also, Connor Worley, who produced today's show.
A reminder that you can always catch full episodes on the Weekly Edition podcast feed.
You can get your news updates at WHRO.org and the WHRO Reports podcast feed. For all of us at WHRO and WHRV, I'm Barry Graham.
And I'm Jordan Christie. Have a great weekend.